Welcome to KUOW Speakers Forum. I'm your host, John O'Brien. In this episode, the days of asking the last one leaving Seattle to turn out the lights are long gone. So, when we think about parks and open spaces, what's ahead for one of the fastest growing cities in the U.S.? Why not drop a lid over I-5 downtown and make our current open spaces more welcoming for all? Think Occidental Park. Or listen seriously to a 9-year-old's ideas about the Roosevelt Reservoir. It's an exciting time to catch up on and get involved in envisioning the great public spaces that will help sustain our growing region. KUOW, the Seattle Public Library, and Seattle's Office of Planning and Community Development hosted this conversation with national and local experts to help the community at large better understand the issues and opportunities we face. KUOW's Posey Gruner moderated the discussion. This How Can Seattle Grow More Public Space event took place at the Seattle Public Library's Central Library on July 24th. Sonia Harris recorded the discussion. We're presenting our broadcast version here. To listen to the full event, go to kuow.org/speakersforum.
My name is Valerie Wunder, and I'm the Community Engagement Manager here at the Seattle Public Library, and I'm very glad to welcome you here tonight. The library is deeply committed to creating opportunities for dialogue around issues that are important to community, and for creating opportunities for you to hear from and share with thought leaders and government agencies and others that create the policies and implement the policies that affect your lives. Because of this, we're very pleased to be partnering with the Office of Planning and Community Development and KUOW on this program tonight, the second of the Urban Innovation Speakers Series. And now, it is my pleasure to introduce Sam Assefa, the Director of the Office of Planning and Community Development. Thank you.
Thank you, Valerie. And thank you all for coming in this beautiful evening to talk about public spaces indoor. But you're doing it in this fantastic library, beautiful library, so I'm pretty sure it means a lot to you, and we really appreciate that you're here. OPCD launched this speaker series last March. I think some of you participated as a community forum to explore best practices on issues and forces that are shaping Seattle today and in the future. So through this process, we bring experts from around the country to share new perspectives and ideas on urban planning, housing, transportation, climate change, public spaces, among others. Our first event on March focused on affordable housing. Tonight's event will focus on outdoor public spaces, and future events will focus on integrated transportation solutions, trends in environmental resiliency and sustainability, and other pertinent topics that would inform our own policies here in Seattle. So this evening, we'll explore the challenges of protecting, expanding, and enhancing public outdoor space in a densifying city. And it's no secret that Seattle is experiencing that challenge significantly today. So as Seattle is growing faster than any major city in the U.S., we added about 27,000 new residents just in 2016 alone. And current trends seem to, from every projection, will continue over the next decade. Anywhere from 120 to 150,000 new residents are possible in Seattle. We know people are choosing to move to Seattle because of its strong economy and job growth. But it's also because of its vibrant culture, stunning natural beauty, plenty of sun, as you've experienced over the last few weeks, and yes, it's great outdoor spaces. One of the pressing questions for Seattle is how we can continue to grow without jeopardizing what makes this city a livable and vibrant city. Now that we are more than 700,000 people, and we expect to add, as I said, about 120 to 150,000 people in the next decade, tonight we ask the question, how can Seattle grow more open space? As cities grow, we need to invest in public space. Acquiring new public open space in urban areas is becoming cost prohibitive. Undeveloped land is limited, and there are many competing priorities for the land that we have. As a growing city, we're not unique with this challenge. We have much to learn from other cities that are innovating in interesting ways to address this challenge, which is why tonight's discussion promises to be informative. This discussion is not going to stay here. We are going to have this information and what we learn from here feed related ongoing work that the city is currently engaged in. We're just launching a new effort in Seattle called Outside Citywide. This effort will be a fresh and integrated look at how we can leverage existing assets and new innovative ideas to ensure high quality and diverse outdoor public spaces for all Seattleites, from urban plazas to natural spaces, from the neighborhood scale to the citywide and regional scale, are offered in the city as we grow. We'll be working with our colleagues across city government, with other agencies like King County and the Port of Seattle, with Seattle Public Schools, with our universities, with community partners, and many others. Our goal through this process is to ensure that current and future generations can continue to enjoy the beauty of this place and what made Seattle a great city, with access to all the benefits that being outdoors can provide. So we look forward to hearing from our panelists this evening, but to inform our work, especially on outside citywide. But it's also very important to hear from you and Seattleites about new ideas, what is working and what's not working for the future of public space in Seattle. So we would like to get you engaged in that process. Just to give you an example, I recently got a wonderful letter from a 9-year-old, Adeline, who lives near Roosevelt Reservoir. She had a lot of ideas about how we should use the Roosevelt Reservoir. Her letter started as, "Dear City Planner, I have a suggestion to make. What if?" And then she listed all these wonderful ideas. And I can tell from the writing that she actually wrote that. So I sent her a note back saying, "I'd love to meet with you and explore your ideas." So we made an appointment at the Roosevelt Reservoir. And when I got there, she waited for me with her dad. And she had an aerial photo of the Roosevelt Reservoir with all these drawings wonderfully illustrated, a creek, a pond, different kinds of trees. And as we were walking around, she's explaining each type of the tree and what it would do if we added those amenities to that area for her, which where she lived a few blocks away. And she actually corrected her dad about the type of trees and the kind of wildlife that exists in the area. Every time he tried to explain, she would just cut him off and she said, "Dad, no, that's not what that is. And this is what this tree is." And it was really impressive. So, and in fact, in her letter, I'll read it. She said, quote, "We might be able to add some sand and gravel and plants, fish and all sorts of things into the reservoir. Then all we need is to do was add water. I know it would be expensive, but I personally think the results would be worth more than cash plus. It could be like a refuge for wildlife in the city." So if a 9-year-old can be that engaged, I hope you have no excuse not to engage. So please sign up for email updates on Outside Citywide. I think that site is on the screen. The website is seattle.gov/OPCD, but if you're on social media, hashtag outside citywide to share your ideas and innovations that you can come up with in Seattle or other places through that website. So we'll be sending you more information through that site about this integrated effort. I'm going to start now to introduce KUOW's Posy Gruner, who will serve as a moderator for tonight's discussion. Posy produces content for KUOW's Region of Boom team, which explores how Seattle's growth is affecting the region. As a producer, Posy identifies people with something important to say, whether they're making the news, analyzing the news, or affected by the news. when talking about growth, that has meant talking to environmentalists about why they're investing in affordable housing, talking to artists about why they're capturing vanishing Seattle, or talking to small town tour guides about ghost towns in the mountains. She's produced a series of interviews about Seattle 2035, the regional comprehensive plan, and about Seattle's creation of a metropolitan parks district. In short, Posey talks to people about growth for a living and then tries to make sense of it for people like me, the 9-year-old and 90-year-olds as well. So please help me welcome Posey to the podium.
Hello, everyone. Thanks, Sam. So think about this. What do you value in society? What kind of space would reflect that? We're at a critical time, so let's not waste a minute. Uva. So Uva Brandis is a professor of practice at Georgetown University. He served as a senior vice president at the Urban Land Institute, where he directed research and global programs on climate change and sustainable urban development. And from 2000 to 2008, he was the managing director of the Anacostia Waterfront Initiative in DC, which he's going to tell us all a little bit about. Welcome, Uva.
Thank you so much.
So you've said that big ideas by urban planners and policymakers have to be translated into real projects, and that needs to be done through the public and private investment process. So I understand you can give us some examples of how that works.
Yeah. So first of all, thank you so much, Posey. Thank you, Valerie and Sam, for inviting me here. It's wonderful. It's wonderful to be here in this building and to have this conversation. It's a real treat for me. Thank you. So what I mean by that is, especially with parks, we have lots of aspirations associated with our public realm. Of course, we have lots of aspirations associated with our cities. But when it comes to realizing those goals, we have to get pragmatic and practical. And one of the things that I find so fascinating about public open space is that there are a series of steps. Sometimes big steps, sometimes little steps, but they are incremental steps that are finite, tangible, usually involve money, and usually involve money, and that money can come from any number of different places. Usually it comes from the private sector through capital improvement plans, but more and more and more, we're seeing a whole host of partnerships emerge around the public realm. And so I'll talk about that a little bit more in a second. So I'm just, I've brought a couple of slides with me here from Washington, and these are just slides of parks that have been built over the last 10 years or so. So this is a park called Canal Park. It's a site of an old canal. It used to be one of the most important parking lots for public school buses. And through a public-private partnership, including through private donations, this park was built. Next slide, please. And this is the same park in the summer. Next slide. We've done a lot of work, as many cities have, on our waterfronts. This is an example of a long-term public-private partnership where the city partnered with a private developer to organize a new public realm where there was none. This is a former brownfield site. It's actually a Superfund site. And now is a regional park, not just for this neighborhood, but and not just for the city, but really for the region. This is a new place for people to come together. This is Yards Park. Part of Yards Park was responding to a problem that we have in Washington, and that is the challenge of heterogeneity. We have lots of federal parks controlled by the National Park Service that are expanses of green. On the other hand, we have lots of city parks that tend to be organized around community centers and schools. And what we didn't have in Washington until very recently is a set of new public realm projects, not always parks, but public realm, that also invite a new kind of commerce to happen. Some of this, I'm thinking now about special markets, In this case, a restaurant, a very high-end restaurant, accompanied by other price points in dining, but located within a park, so that you can imagine this public open space being accessible to people who just want to sit and have a glass of wine. Unimaginable in Washington until just a couple of years ago. And finally, these are some slides taken from a new neighborhood in the city called NoMa, north of Massachusetts Avenue. And this is a good example of how public realm strategies are being driven into the regular, quote unquote, the regular public realm. This is a street that includes a major stormwater retention strategy, as well as a multimodal transportation strategy, and is really the main street for a series of new, a new population in the city. And this is taken from that same streetscape. You can see the legacy of a street is really changed in this case and turned into a place to just hang out. And next slide, in a place where many people can come together. And I'll talk about that a little bit more in conversation.
So this is all great, but what about us? So what are the lessons that you can see in this place for cities like Seattle or other cities?
Well, I think Washington and Seattle actually have a lot in common right now, certainly have a lot in common in terms of the public discourse around changing neighborhoods, gentrification, a new group of young people, you know, some people thinking young people invading the city, but certainly a new class of people coming into the city. And we've used our public realm strategy to try to bring different people together. It's been the overarching goal for all of our park projects. And similarly, and this is not unique to Washington and Seattle, we have a new agenda with respect to the public realm. Some people call it green infrastructure. There are other technical issues associated with stormwater management. These are realities that need to be resolved within the infrastructure of the city. And what we've tried to do in Washington is to start doing that in the public realm through the creation of new public space and new public spaces. And I think that's something that we have in common. And it's a huge challenge for many cities. And I think Seattle and Washington are at the vanguard of those strategies.
Public-private partnership can be a dirty word for some people. What would you say to them?
Well, it's a reality. The private sector builds the city. It's the reality. The public sector has a small sliver of investment that it makes in building cities. And so those investments have to be thought of together. They're often thought of sequentially as catalysts. The public realm in so many cities was really, you think of Central Park in New York, right? This was a catalyst to attract private investment to the city. More and more, though, with greater levels of vigilance, greater sensitivity to the multiple stakeholders and the interests of multiple stakeholders, we can weave this process together and accelerate an investment into the public realm. Some of the examples that I've shown you are illustrate that, where the public has actually not taken the lead in the investment, has acted more as a regulator, and the investment has come from the private sector. But again, you know, close working relationships and transparency are key to making those kinds of projects happen.
Great. I see we already have lots of questions, so we'll get to those in the question portion, but that's a good sign. And for now, we'll move on and speak with Mami. So Mami Hara, some of you may recognize her face or the name. Mami Hara is the general manager of Seattle Public Utilities. She's in charge of making sure that great drinking water comes out of your tap. She's in charge of reducing the waste that's sent to landfills. And she helps to keep stormwater waste out of our rivers and lakes. So what does it take to be good at that job? If you go by Mami's experience, it is degrees in design from two Ivy League universities, 2.5 decades of experience in planning and design, and a track record of planning and designing civic projects on a really big scale. We're talking about waterfronts and river corridors, open space systems, trail networks, neighborhoods, and cultural institutions. Mommy was also the consultant to UVA on the Anacostia Water Project that we mentioned before. Before Seattle, Hara was the chief of staff at Philadelphia Water, where she helped implement national models for green stormwater infrastructure that Seattle looks to as a model. She was appointed in 2016 by Mayor Ed Murray, so we're really just getting started here. Welcome, Mommy.
Thank you.
So, help explain this for me. So you're the GM of a public utility. You manage wastewater, among other things. Why are we here talking about open space?
Most folks are familiar with the idea of protecting watersheds for clean drinking water. That's something that's been embedded in the American consciousness for many, many decades. But increasingly, stormwater management is an important part of utilities' responsibilities and urban communities' responsibilities, particularly with the exacerbating effects of climate change. We'll see that that's even more of an issue. And so really, water management is increasingly about land management. It always has been, but not really posited strongly on people's minds.
So we're talking here about open space innovation. That's the point of this whole exercise that we're doing. Open space innovation sounds kind of trendy, like the same people who like natural popsicles would like open space. Is it new?
We use the term open space because, unfortunately, our field hasn't really come up with a lot of great names. But the kinds of terms that are used come and go, just like the kinds of typologies of open space that that capture people's imaginations at any given time. You'll find that at one point people are really, really passionate about covering highways, right? Or it might become about another typology. But in their reinvigoration of those typologies, there's an opportunity to reclaim space for public use. So, I'm all for the cycle of interest in different types of open space. Seattle has really led out on innovation in many areas, covering highways, for example, with Freeway Park, community gardens at a large scale through pea patches, the preservation of scenic vistas, like at University of Washington's Rainier Vista and also Volunteer Park. That's a really big contribution to open space planning. The green infrastructure, Seattle and Portland experimented with it well before other cities who adopted green infrastructure at scale even had, we thought it was a glimmer in their eyes, right? So, for Seattle, there's another kind of generation of innovation that I think that they could look to for cities who have taken Seattle's ideas and implemented those innovations at scale. Right, which is an innovation itself. Programmatic, to bring programs up to a big scale requires a lot of different kinds of financing and management and stewardship innovations. So, you look at Philadelphia, who's taken green infrastructure, at a much bigger scale, or communities like Copenhagen, who are looking at flood management through green infrastructure, which I think Seattle was also a leader on, you look at the Atlanta Beltline for large-scale implementation of brownfield conversion, which Seattle led out with on Gas Works Park. The list goes on and on in terms of, how those ideas have really captured people's imaginations. If I could just insert two things, though. There are two areas, though, that I think that Seattle has not really been a leader in that I think that there is a lot of room for, that I've seen a lot of discourse about, and that is schoolyard greening, particularly for stormwater and, other kinds of community benefit, and also large, iconic, centrally located parks.
Great. So Seattle has more people now than it had when it created some of these parks that you mentioned, which means we have less space and more needs. What can we do about that?
What can, In many cities who are facing constrained areas for open space, but increased need, you know, environmentally and socially, are looking at hybrids of open space types. You know, really, you know, very multifunctional design that that brings, you know, a lot of benefit, but it's, you know, it takes really tailored approaches, right? For any of the ideas that we talk about today, there's always the issue of fit, right? You have to fit to the place and the people and the needs of your time. But for example, you know, green infrastructure in schoolyards, right? You know, that's, instead of just greening it for recreation, that's a kind of hybrid. You know, the Anacostia Waterfront Initiative, I think, was a big hybrid. You know, Uwe didn't even talk about a lot of the kinds of functions that were included in the planning for those kinds of open spaces.
So I think you have some examples for us of, yep, here we go.
Oh, I'm not going to speak to them individually. You can just let them roll
okay, as I talk. Great.
Yeah. You asked me to include these so that I could talk about some of our work in Philadelphia
exactly. Around
water. And a lot of the work that we did around water is absolutely, I'm sure, not interesting to this audience, but with respect to open space. Philadelphia is an interesting city to look at because affordability is a huge issue. You know, I guess in Seattle, the median household income is over 90,000 a household, and in Philadelphia, it's still less than 38,000 per household. So that's a big, big difference in the in what people can afford with respect to open space investment and management and capital work. And but Philadelphia, just like Seattle, has clean water mandates that it needs to address. And so we were able to negotiate with our regulators a novel approach that was really predicated on the issue of just people not having the money to pay for extraordinary measures that's predicated on the development of green infrastructure. So theoretically, instead of spending you know, $10, $12 billion on tunnels over a long period of time, it would be investing $2.5 billion in green infrastructure to change the way that water is managed. And that meant that we had to drive a lot of partnerships with different kinds of landowners or land managers, you know, different kinds of NGOs, which was great, right? You know, that turned the utility from a very inward-facing utility into one that was, you know, that really had to address the needs of its community. And so it was a great experience for me in that I got to really look at the nexus of workforce development and economic opportunity and kind of really wealth-building strategies for this community through the clean water funds that we were spending.
It's really helping me get a perspective on the large scale that I introduced you about. Thatcher, hi.
Hi.
Thatcher Bailey is the executive director of the Seattle Parks Foundation. The Seattle Parks Foundation envisions a thriving system of public spaces throughout this city. They believe that's possible through connections with community, philanthropic, and public sector partners. And Thatcher points out something simple, which is people love parks. And he also points out that when people talk about how they love parks, they almost always talk about connections to friends, family, and community. So, hi, Thatcher.
Hey.
So what do you mean by that?
Well, I think that, is this too loud for folks? Okay, you got it. I think, weirdly, for something that is so emotionally important for all of us, we tend to dismiss the power of that fact or tend to put it off to the side when we think about the city challenges and opportunities that face us. But we're confronted every day in our office, working with 60 or 70 different groups of all sizes in all neighborhoods around the city, about this kind of deep connection people have to one another, not only in their experience of their public spaces, but in their creation of these public spaces. And we're convinced that that really is a kind of a superpower that we have as a city, and that there's a quote that I've overused a million times because a woman up in Lake City was trying to reclaim a piece of SDOT property, a little stream going through it, and no one had been paying any attention. And over a lot of months and with a lot of effort, she finally got volunteers together, and they've done an amazing job. And her line was, you know, we started as a neighborhood, we ended up as a community. And those are tough words because they seem a little hackneyed, but I think as we face problems of displacement and affordability and transportation crises, we have an opportunity to think in bigger terms about the idea of livability that often gets left to the side, that actually encompasses all those challenges and addresses issues of equity in a way that actually is more like dessert than vegetables. It's about rewarding. So I think what we mean by people's emotional connection to parks is that parks build great communities and great communities build and sustain parks. And that's something that really will drive change in a positive way for the city, or does drive change in a positive way.
Sounds good. So how do we, the topic of how do we grow more open space? What do you think?
I think there's actually lots of ways that they're right in front of us, and we're not necessarily paying attention to them all the time. We don't think of them at top of the list. One, and I imagine everyone in this room can think about a certain park or public space that you know where very few people go. And it's like, well, hey, let's make these places that people go. Our office is very near to Occidental Park, and we were part of an effort to invest in the DSA programming Occidental and Westlake Parks to make them more welcoming for all people. And it started off as a park that people would, or a square that people would walk around to avoid because there were just a few sketchy folks maybe selling drugs. And now it's a vibrant urban gathering place. So in a way, you're creating a new park by making it a place that people want to go. I mean, the others you guys have talked about, like making streets places that people want to go, not just go through. That's starting in Seattle, and there's enormous numbers of great ideas on the books to kind of make that happen more effectively and more dramatically. Our public realm is just open for opportunities to create these kind of places. And I think we have the opportunity to create parks out of places that are, you know, basically out of thin air. You know, we're happy to be involved with the Lid I-5 folks. There is an opportunity to expand on what's happened with Freeway Park or in Mercer Island or even with the new Lid by Montlake, and recognize that that's just real estate that can be parkland, it can be housing, it can address a whole range of social needs, and it's right there in front of us. I think a key element is designing all these places so they're parts of connected systems. I mean, we're a great city insofar as we're fortunate to be part of the Olmsted legacy. So we've got this kind of baked into our thinking about how do you know, great parks connected by great boulevards. We'll just dial that up and recognize that doing one-off public space improvements in this neighborhood and that neighborhood can be so much more effective if we think about how we link those centers together with green, safe places for people to travel A, point A to point B to point C. And finally, I'm gonna hammer on this all night, making sure that we're supporting communities, leaders, and volunteers to make all this happen. That's where the creativity is, that's where the resources are. Anything we can do to drive more resources to those groups, to connect those groups up one with another, with other NGOs and with the public agencies that are bringing dollars to the table, makes this city a more diverse, welcoming place for all users of public space in the city.
So can you highlight an example of this thing you're talking
about?
Yeah,
I mean,
the look, you can.
Look there. So this actually is a map that came out of a neighborhood planning process. We had nothing to do with it, although we're huge advocates for kind of what this represents, and we're involved in some of the projects here. And this is how you think really holistically about addressing a whole set of needs that a neighborhood with a set of kind of significant problems is working together with enormous numbers of clusters of community groups to recreate Rainier Beach. And I think there's a sweet little opportunity. If you look at Henderson right in the middle there, which connects up the light rail station and goes all the way east across to the water, there's a little project called now Link to Lake. And that is a connection that now is barely there, because anybody walks down Henderson, it's not an experience that you want to have. It's like the traffic is awful, there's sketchy corners, there's places you don't feel safe, and you certainly don't feel connected. But if you look at the possibilities of how that connects up to green space on the west side, and then down to an actual beach. And one of the questions is, where is the beach in Rainier Beach? Well, it's right there at a boat ramp. So you'll see in a second a picture of how that beach can be re-envisioned. And right next to that is Beersheba Park, and right next to that is Rainier Beach Urban Farm, which is finally opening after any number of years, was an abandoned parks department nursery site that the community got together and said, hey, why don't we create a working farm here? And you can go on to that next picture. And I show pictures of kids working at this farm, not because kids in parks are always the kind of picture you want to show, but because in this particular neighborhood, having gone to a lot of different community meetings, there's a huge focus on how do you make public spaces as alternatives for other kinds of activities that are far less desirable for kids to get involved in. And this farm, which produces enormous amount of produce and job training and environmental training, is a testament to a community getting together to make that happen. And finally, the last picture, which is that beach at the end of the Link to Lake corridor, what is now a boat ramp with no real sense of being a beach can be multipurposed into being another access point into Lake Washington, connecting up to this whole set of green spaces, and once again, kind of being a signal turning point for a community that's working in many different ways to transform itself into something livable and welcoming for the diversity of residents who live there.
Thank you, Thatcher. Thank you, Mami. Thank you, Uva. Now we will get to your many questions. I also have some questions here in my deck from people on Facebook, people who wrote in. But the first one, actually, Thatcher, I'm going to give to you, which is, what will it take to accelerate the community efforts to reinvest in Freeway Park and expand it by letting I-5 for acres of new public space? What will it take?
Well, I love that question, because I think I was talking to someone earlier about we're fortunate to be directly involved with the folks championing Lit I-5, the Lit I-5 project, who are an awesome team of people, and we obviously we've worked closely with the Freeway Parks folks as well. What it will take is what's already kind of in place. These are folks who have done amazing organizing within the Capitol Hill and downtown and First Hill communities, who are making the kinds of connections and slowly, incrementally building a case for something that at first seemed like an insanely expensive, outrageous idea. But very patiently, they've made the case to decision makers and community leaders like, wait, here's why this makes sense. Here's kind of how it can happen. Here's the next step. And the next step is a very expensive study of like what it would actually take to physically make this transformation. But all along the way, with the eye on the prize of when this happens, you're getting real estate transformed that didn't exist before, at a cheaper cost per square foot that you can get it anywhere near that part of town, and you're addressing a whole host of public space needs and possible housing needs and other development needs that are also drive an economy that makes a litting project like this happen. I think it's, again, what it takes is community leadership, and they've got it.
Great. And also money, right?
Well, it takes an enormous amount. Here's the thing about money. It's just money. And truly, we've got to remember that there's no such thing as too much of a good park. There's still no such thing as like, oh, we have too many great public spaces, we can't afford anymore. No, the benefits from these things are generationally significant. So you make the case, the money will be there. And there's endless numbers of mechanisms and political will to make that happen.
Thank you. So I feel like that leads into this question, which I'm going to direct towards Uwe, but any of you, if you have contributions, you can add to it. So this question is, how do we create new funding sources to support our public spaces? It seems our current approach isn't keeping up with demand.
That's great. And that's a great follow-on to
high with the microphone.
That's a great follow-on to the previous question. So I agree it's just money. But behind the money is value. And so I think the conversations in cities like Seattle and Washington and many other cities that are fortunate enough to be in the midst of a building boom, the conversation needs to get beyond straight public aspirations for open space and to really get into a much more nuanced, holistic understanding of how public and private value is created in tandem. And when you get to that place, and when you get to those sometimes very difficult conversations between stakeholders and people that are not used to talking to one another, you get to a place where you realize that there's tremendous value created in the private sector when you create sound, long-term public value. And when you get to that place, the money appears, often magically, as you've just suggested. But you have to be able to think about the integration of the public realm into the larger city and think about and really work through, sometimes difficult, sometimes easy, questions around who benefits and how. And so those are the conversations that get you to an implementation conversation that sometimes can produce extraordinary, very large projects like the freeway park.
So our audience member has written a very smart follow-up question to that in the past. So their question is, how can we pivot away from ineffective and inaccessible privately owned public spaces, such as the proposed roof garden for the convention center expansion that will be 5 stories above ground?
So I'm not familiar with that project, so I'm not going to comment on that. But I do think that in addition to what I just said, there is vigilance necessary, right? The public needs to own the public space. And so if benefits are created and accrued and not properly maintained and accounted for, and if the stewardship practices are not put into place, then of course that value system can break down and sometimes bad things can happen. And I think the poster child for that is the legacy of publicly accessible private spaces in New York City. There's a huge program created in New York in the 70s and 80s. It was never properly cared for
or designed,
and those spaces were created. They didn't live up to their promise. And it was a breakdown in the trust between the public and private.
May I go back to Uwe's comment about magic? I just want to add that, I agree entirely with the idea of value and designing and planning to maximize the value and return for both the public and private sector. But the design of those instruments, those magical instruments that capture value and make clear what the respective contributions are, is an art, and it's an evolving one. There are value capture instruments that we could talk about, at length, and I think that's a different conversation. But there are also old ways of thinking about funding for open space, at a regional, or even larger scale. Where cities like Seattle and others are looked as kind of donors to open space conservation in ex-urban areas. And that leads to, great conservation strategies, but not necessarily sustainable ones, because we're not looking at how to make cities livable and to promote densification and reduce development pressure, reduce congestion, through making cities more livable, right? And so I think that's an important consideration in how we should be looking at the flows of funds, at different scales of governance, and also looking to more novel ways of investing in open space. You know, I'm not advocating that that the utility can pay for everything, but leveraging utility funds through different kinds of investment schemes, you know, that's kind of the magic that we should be looking at.
I have a specific question for you from this audience member who says, I am especially interested in a response from Mami Hara. This audience member says, I am interested in hearing your positions on existing green spaces, especially surplus lands and or assets that could be transformed or restored into green spaces. I am one of the many residents of Lake Forest Park who have been raising monies through local donations and grants to assist the city of Lake Forest Park to purchase 5-acre woods as an urban park to be restored and enhanced for public enjoyment and education, et cetera. I'm sorry, I can't read the rest because I have to hold on to it. So what is your position? This audience member is interested in hearing in your position on existing green spaces, especially surplus lands or assets that could be transformed or restored.
Well, you know, the idea of surplus land is one that, you know, has lots of different perspectives, right? You know, whether something is in excess or needed for risk management later on in the future, or whether you need to, utilities have financial responsibilities that go beyond their abilities just to convey land, you know, at much reduced prices, you know, to the public, because we have rate responsibilities to our ratepayers. But that said, you know, with all those caveats, you know, it is really important for the public sector to look hard at how to partner and in order to create the best possible open space there, you know, that it can help to support. 5-acre woods is, you know, outside Seattle. Just as a little background, the utility owns this land and has held back from selling it for over a decade, so that the citizens of Lake Forest Park could afford to buy it, you know, at market rate, you know, and turn it into a park. And I understand that the community is trying their very best to collect the funds, and we have deferred, and we continue to allow to create some kind of window for them. But ultimately, we do have responsibilities to our ratepayers.
Thank you. So this is a question for everyone, and it's kind of a pushback on the whole notion of this panel itself, which is not as scary as I make it sound. This is a question actually that came to us through the Facebook event page for this event. Dante says, are people just not being resourceful? There are about 105 parks and open spaces listed on the Seattle Parks Department website and 167 on the King County Parks website. I don't really think that we're short on public spaces, even with an increasing population density. There are still plenty of resources within reach. So, comments, thoughts?
Well, let me just kick it off, and I'm sure you'll have local examples. There is an absolute revolution going on with respect to public space stewardship. And so I think even, you know, up until 10, 15 years ago, most of the conversation about the public realm was about building new parks, about creating more stock. And we are now in the middle of an incredibly creative wave of communities using public open space in so many different ways. And you know, it's almost kind of like a cliche now to see, you know, the promotional photograph of people doing yoga in a park, right? That's become like a cliche. But if you think about all of the festivals and the active programming that's occurring in public open spaces, I think we're just at the beginning of that. And it's really thinking about parks less as an end and more as a means. And you can think about that in terms of, you know, green infrastructure, but I think you can also think about that in terms of the culture of the city itself. And so back to my liberal understanding of the public realm.
It's not a dirty word in
exactly.
Seattle.
Exactly. You know, parks are vehicles for people. And we're just beginning to figure out how to unlock that, I think.
Great. So we have another question from the audience, unless you wanted to, please add.
I just wanted to piggyback on that a little bit. I agree with Uwe entirely. But just to get back to the question about do we need more, I don't know the answer in every detail, but you know, in lots of cities, people ask that question, but it's not the quantity of parks that you have. It's where they are, it's who they serve, it's the way that they're designed in order to serve the people and their communities better so that they can act as true platforms of both environmental and cultural production. And so, you know, that's whether it's, so I think that that question of whether you have enough is a bit reductive.
Thank you.
Sure.
Thatcher?
I thank you both, and I'll just add one more thing, which is what Sam and his department are doing is looking at the whole universe of publicly owned land and how that gets deployed. And I think that becomes a really interesting conversation when you're talking about, say, solving a traffic problem that's going to emerge in downtown Seattle over the next 3 years like we've never seen before. And by focusing just on how do you get wheels from one end of town to the other, you're maybe missing out again on kind of how do you think about that as public realm that's available for a whole host of experiences. So again, discrete parks are great, but how do we have park-like social experiences throughout the city that are relevant to our lives? So I think this panel is about a lot more than just building some new parks.
Thanks for streaming this episode of Speakers Forum from KUOW 94.9 Seattle. This How Can Seattle Grow More Public Space event took place at the Seattle Public Library's Central Library on July 24th. Thank you again to Sonia Harris for our recording. You can hear the full event on our website, kuow.org/speakersforum. Tune in again soon.